Up next, we get a loaded episode. Lots to talk about. We got the NBA Finals, my reaction to Game 2, looking ahead to Game 3 to start the show. And then I got a series of interviews. We got some draft prospect interviews later in the show with Bennett Sturts and Aaron Nkrumah, a first-rounder and a second-rounder entering this year's draft. And then before that, I got Chris Haynes talking about this upcoming offseason. Giannis, what's going to happen there? What's he expecting? And then I got DeAndre Jordan talking about the evolution of the big man in the NBA. That's all coming up right now. The all-new 2026 Soccer Pick'em is here just in time for the world's biggest soccer tournament. Make picks each round, earn points, and climb the leaderboard. Play solo, create a private group with friends, join a public group to play with other fans, or even join our Yahoo Sports group to see if you can beat us. Join at yahoofantasy.com/soccerpick'em. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. Going to talk about the Knicks 105-104 Game 2 win over the San Antonio Spurs. It is hard to fathom that the Knicks took both on the road to go up 2-0 heading back to Madison Square Garden. I've never seen the Knicks play a game at MSG when they were good, so I'm fired up to be there Monday and Wednesday night next week for games 3 and 4. Who knows? They got a chance to sweep. We're going to talk about both sides of the Knicks and the Spurs right now, starting with the Knicks side, because this turnaround is just hard to believe. 13 wins in a row now after being down 2-1 against the Atlanta Hawks with a CJ McCollum pull-up jumper in game 3 of that series way back on April 23rd. And here we are, 13 wins later. And after the game, Mikal Bridges is asked about how he's feeling. And he's like, it's like 0-0 still. You know, no complacency. We're not giving up. You know, he's like, I need to be better. There's like this edge that he's playing with, whereas you juxtapose that against the Spurs, Stephon Castle, after game 1, they lose. And he's saying, we still think we're the better team. I really like the Knicks' perspective and the way these guys are really rallying around each other. You can feel the experience. You can feel the confidence. Karl Anthony Towns, towards the end of the second quarter, after a play he made of many against Victor Wembanyama, said, he can't mess with me. He's not on my level. And Kat, the confidence with which he's playing with is just genuinely beautiful to watch. I thought, aside from the buckets, aside from the way he's just attacking those closeouts, blowing by Victor Wembanyama, aside from the defense, put that all aside, the playmaking that he is showing, the pass he made, he grabbed an offensive board in the second or third quarter underneath the rim. And it looked like he was looking up at the rim for a putback. And then suddenly he just wrapped the ball around 4 Spurs defenders for a corner 3. And I'm like, this dude is just seeing the game at a slow level. It is moving in slow motion for him. And through these 2 games, Karl Anthony Towns, in my opinion, is very clearly the finals MVP through 2 games. We'll see how the remainder of the series goes, but Kat has just been sensational, and he is outplaying Victor Wembanyama on both ends of the floor. He looks like a fully realized version of himself. And I mean, for a guy that has taken so many hits over the years for this reason or that reason, whether it's the way he acts or whether it's some of the mistakes he's made, some of the playoff failures. Last year, I'll tell you what, I was one of the people that thought the Knicks should probably try to trade Karl Anthony Towns in the summer. I thought he might be holding them back on both ends, especially defensively. I mean, he's making me and a lot of other people eat their words because of the way he is performing now. And good for him, man. Like, I'm rooting for that guy. It's hard not to root for him, the way he's been vulnerable talking about the loss of his mother and what that means for him. It's pretty cool to see him use that stage and open up in the way that he has. And yeah, the guy's just playing basketball at a high level. And I think that ball movement we feel with the Knicks, right? I mean, ever since they put the ball into Kat's hands in that first round series against Atlanta, when he came out and he had like 14 points and 10 boards in game 4, and it's all snowballed from there. The Knicks ball movement in that third quarter possession where they had 5 attacks into the paint and then a final kick out from Brunson for the corner 3. And it's like just this good to great to amazing basketball that they play. It is so selfless. It really, I mean, I saw the Villanova basketball account quote tweeted a video of that play, and they said Villanova basketball. And it's true. You can just see the chemistry. You can see the movement with players' bodies and the ball itself. Quick decisions. This Knicks offense is playing at an elite level. And I'll talk about the defense in a second. But sticking with the offensive side, end of the third quarter, you have Karl Anthony Towns in foul trouble, which, I mean, those are some nice try, Tony Brothers. Those are some horrible fouls on Cat. You have Jalen Brunson out as well. He needed a breather. And the Knicks have a lineup of Bridges, Shamet, McBride, Alvarado, Mitchell Robinson. Wemby was still out there for the Spurs on the other side. And at that moment of the game, I'm thinking to myself, well, here comes a Spurs run. Nope, that's not what happened. Over the next 4 minutes, the remainder of the third quarter and the first minute of the fourth quarter, the Knicks outscored the Spurs 11-3. They had an 11-3 run. And I looked at the offsides tracker. They have a great box score tracker. You can customize and find cool custom stats live during games. And I looked at it this morning for what happened during that stretch. And it's crazy. The Spurs only took 5 shots during that 11-3 run. The Knicks took 10. The Knicks were 5 of 10 during that stretch. They had 3 offensive rebounds. Mitchell Robinson was inhaling everything at the rim. Mikal Bridges hit those 2 beautiful pull-up jumpers. Spurs were only 1 of 5. Couldn't get anything going offensively against this really tough, hard-nosed Knicks defense. And with neither of their stars out there. And I thought that end of third quarter run into the fourth kind of led to what happened in the final 90 seconds of the game. The Spurs made a 14-0 run, a miraculous run to make it a competitive ending of the game. And then in the last 90 to 100 seconds where things collapsed for Wemby and for the Spurs, what did we see Mike Brown do? Who was on the other side of those Wemby jumpers? It's Mitchell Robinson. Cat, as incredibly as he's defended Wemby throughout this series and done a good job containing his drives and a good job bothering him everywhere on the floor, Mike Brown goes with Mitchell Robinson on these plays where Wemby took a face-up jumper from the left side of the floor and then the right side of the floor, the one that he missed to end the game. And Mitchell Robinson is right there using his massive 7-plus-foot frame to extend and heavily contest those Wemby shots. I wish I were in the arena last night just to ask Mike Brown about that decision. I wonder, like, specifically, did he expect Wemby to settle? Is that why he went with a longer-armed guy to heavily contest those shots? Because Wemby certainly was settling. And I think for Mike Brown, he continues to coach his butt off in these games, in these whole playoffs with those decisions. And then on the other side, Mitch Johnson and the Spurs, it felt like it collapsed to me. Wemby in particular, the first face-up jumper he took with around 45 seconds left in the game, the Spurs were trying to do a 2-for-1. I didn't think the possession had any offensive imagination. Then on the last play, you have Fox dribbling the ball a little bit too long, and then Wemby taking a pull-up jumper and no time remaining for a rebound opportunity. Just, it didn't feel like a team in the final 90 seconds playing with urgency or intelligence, and those two plays aren't even the ones that really are the most symbolic of what we're talking about here. Wemby, with about 100 seconds left in the game, he grabs the ball around the left baseline and dribbles behind the three-point line for a step-back corner three with like 8 seconds left on the shot clock, and he airballed it. And it was a terrible shot. I had Amin El-Hassan on my show after game one, and Amin, I thought about him immediately because Amin said to me that 30-footer Wemby took against OKC that helped in his 40-20 game in overtime that tied it up. Amin said that was a bad shot. I don't totally agree, but to Amin's point, it's not the highest shot quality shot to take in that moment. Like, you can find more efficient shots. That shot, the corner three by Wemby, was even worse. He should have found something better. I thought the Spurs should have found something better with the face-up jumpers Wemby took. I think they fed Wemby too much. I think they underrated having a different guy take that shot and allowing Wemby to be on the offensive boards crashing. And then never mind the turnover. They get a stop on Jalen Brunson. Wemby grabs the rebound. Castle's looking back towards him, wondering if the ball is coming his way, and turns his back on Wemby, who passes it off of Castle's back. There's 5 different video angles of this, some taken from the crowd, some from the broadcast. And if you're divvying up the blame here, I think on the court, Wemby deserves the most blame. I think he got a little frazzled in that moment. I think he was a little bit nervous in that moment. Castle does deserve some blame. You're a guard. You should be looking for the ball. You shouldn't just turn your back and kind of just hustle, just jog up the court a little bit. If you're going to hustle, hustle. It felt like he wasn't really even pushing the pace at all in that moment. But most of all, though, I still think Mitch Johnson, you just got to call a timeout in that moment. Can you really trust your 7'7" big man in his first NBA finals with a handful of seconds remaining in the game to find the highest quality shot in that moment with all these young players on the court around him, some struggling as well to create quality shots? I think Mitch Johnson needs to call a timeout in that moment, get the team gathered, and have a good after timeout play ready to go. All that said, he hasn't shown much of an ability with some great, highly creative ATOs. And that's my issue with those other plays. But that turnover play, I mean, my God, like it was really the LeBron James, J.R. Smith meme all over again, but with Wemby and Castle doing it to each other, because you can point the fingers at each other. I just think ultimately Wemby rushed that pass a little bit too much. More than anything else. And it's just been a struggle. It's been a struggle for him in these games. Karl Anthony Towns is straight up outplaying Victor Wembanyama, straight up just destroying him. And like Wemby has the raw numbers, you can point to those and say he's still producing. But the fact is you watch the games with your own eyes, Wemby isn't making the type of impact that we have seen him make before. Defensively, we're seeing a bit of the formula here. Karl Anthony Towns spacing him out, the ability to drive past him. If there's one hole in Wemby's defense, I know this is something that the skeptics of him talked about throughout the season. It was perimeter defense, isolation defense, closeout defense. That's exactly what we're seeing against Karl Anthony Towns. And then offensively, Wemby doesn't have a go-to move. That we've known that already. It's already been a question. It was the argument against him for MVP, the fact he's not a self-creator. He's a finisher, not a starter, not a creator off the dribble. We're seeing that. He's got sloppy footwork. He needs to get better. He's still not at elite efficiency as a pull-up shooter or as a driver to the basket. He needs others to create for him, which is why I don't get the Spurs not running more things through their guards in that last 90 seconds. You have Harper and Castle and Fox. You have three guys, Harper and Fox specifically, that I think it would make sense to run some plays through in the end of that game. Maybe Dylan Harper is your Kobe to Victor Wembanyama being your Shaquille O'Neal. Maybe that's what it is in these endgame situations. And yet, they're just playing through Wemby. They're letting him take the face-up jumper, even though he's a sub 40% guy from mid-range this year. They're letting him bring the ball up the floor with 10 seconds left in the game, even though you have all these guards on the roster. And I'm a little baffled by that decision-making down the stretch of the game. And it just speaks to the inexperience of the coach and of the players more than anything else. And ultimately, you know, Dylan Harper did not have the type of game that he did in the first quarter of game one or the rest of game one. And yet, still a plus 12 in the game. The offense just feels like it flows more with him out there. He's a great defender with size and strength. We saw how he could move his feet laterally, causing the backcourt violation on Jalen Brunson in that game as well. They got to play Harper more than 32 minutes in game two, more than 29 minutes from game one. They got to just feed Harper a bit more and see what you can get out of him. And I also think, other than that, like Mitch Johnson, playing 10 guys might not be it. You might have to make some tough calls here. Keldon Johnson looks borderline unplayable. The Cornette minutes are terrible again. And I think you have to also wonder about, what do you do with Julian Champagne? Champagne, very important as a shooter. Do not get me wrong, but the Knicks are able to hide Jalen Brunson on Champagne basically the whole game. Brunson is just able to stick to Champagne. No, Champagne's not going to do anything off the dribble. He's just going to shoot threes. And it's not working for San Antonio. So I wonder if we'll see them go more to the three guards That's a lineup they rarely ever use during the regular season. We've barely seen it at all during the playoffs with Fox, Castle, and Harper out there. And maybe Devin Vassell at the four in some minutes, Keldon Johnson in some other minutes. But I think having as much creation around Wemby as possible is what will really stress that Knicks defense that is just executing to perfection. They are nailing the game plan. Every time Wemby rolls hard to the rim, there's four guys on the paint. They are collapsing inside. They're bumping Wemby on his drives to throw off the timing of those pick and rolls. They are just nailing this game plan. And ultimately, if maybe having more ball handling on the floor, guys who can make plays off the dribble, make quick decisions, maybe that's something that could work against this Knicks defense in the same way that the Knicks are causing issues for the Spurs defense with that play I talked about earlier when they just attack closeout after closeout after closeout, leading to a corner three with 0.1 left in the shot clock. And look, man, like I talk about the way they're bumping Wemby. Richard Jefferson, I got all the respect in the world for you, but I could not believe what he said during the broadcast where he's like, I think there's too much physicality. Dude, what are you talking about? To me, I mean, look, the beauty is in the eye of the beholder, to each their own. But to me, I am loving this style of play. It feels like a perfect blend between the physicality that people have nostalgia for in the 90s. And with the game today, with the space and the flow, it just blends together in a way that I think is like a really genuinely gorgeous style of basketball. I am having the time of my life watching these playoffs with how physical and how much spacing and pace we're seeing. It is just a perfect blend. I hope they don't change it. What they do need to change is Tony Brothers with those ticky-tack fouls on Karl Anthony Towns to get him out of the game in the third quarter. That's ridiculous. Just absurd. I couldn't believe it. I mean, good for the Knicks winning this game too, and that's in part why it was just such a heartbreaker for the Spurs. You get a chance to win the game on a night the officiating was in your favor, and you blow it at home after a 14-0 comeback in the fourth quarter when the Knicks collapsed. Is there any reason to believe the Spurs are going to come back in the series? I don't think so. I don't think the Spurs are going to be able to win four out of the next five with the Knicks having three home games at Madison Square Garden just to need to win two of them to hoist the Larry O'B. I don't see it happening. If there's any hope, you know, you lost just by 10 in game one. You lost just by one in game two. You stopped pressuring Brunson down the stretch of the game during that 14-0 run. That helped. There's going to be, I would think, rotation changes, perhaps lineup changes for San Antonio. You got to just try everything at this point. You can't just do the same thing and expect it to be any different. Because, by the way, Jalen Brunson could be due for a highly efficient banger of a performance too. He very well could be due for one of those. It might not just be Cat and Bridges and Alvarado and Deuce McBride and OG Anunoby and all these other guys on the Knicks. There could be a Brunson game coming. And so I would fear that if I'm the San Antonio Spurs. I think we might be seeing a sweep. This feels like it very well could be 07 LeBron, where he gets matched up with the San Antonio Spurs after a miraculous playoff run, beating the Pistons, the favorites on the way, just like Wemby beat the OKC Thunder. It feels like that. It just feels like that. It just brings me right back to that time. And just like with the moment with LeBron scoring 25 straight points against the Pistons, and you're like, oh my God, he's the best player in the world. Just like the 40-20 game against game one and game one against the Thunder. It just feels exactly the same. It just feels exactly the same as that series. That's what I think we're going to get. That's what I'm expecting entering game three. But we got two really awesome games so far in the finals. These have been incredible to watch. I can't wait for game three on Monday night in New York City at Madison Square Garden. I'm fired up about it, man. I've seen a lot of great concerts there. I've yet to see a great Knicks team play a great game. So I can't wait till Monday. All right, up next, we got Chris Haynes talking about this upcoming NBA offseason. Chris Haynes and I talked for about 10 minutes about Giannis's future, what to expect on draft night as well. That's a very fun conversation. Then I got DeAndre Jordan, former NBA All-Star, still an NBA player. He told me he's not retiring yet, still wants to play. DJ and I talked about the evolution of the big man position and some other stuff as well. And then after that, I got two draft prospect interviews. We got Bennett Sturts. He's a potential top 20, top 25 pick in the 26th draft, a point guard out of Iowa, spent 4 years there. I was very impressed by his interview. And then I talked to a local kid, Aaron Nkrumah. Aaron is from Worcester. I'm from Brockton. So we talked about that and his journey to the league, which has been a crazy roller coaster ride. So that's today's podcast. That's all coming up right now. All right, now joining me, NBA reporter Chris Haynes. Chris, what's up, man?
Hold on, man. Before we get to all that, how did you leave Jalen Brunson off your All-NBA, man?
I'm a dummy. I'm a dummy, okay? I overthought it. I picked Jalen Johnson, Danny Avdia, Tyrese Maxey. I'm not mad about the Maxey choice. I thought Maxey had
so I think I had him on my team as well.
I think that was fair, but I made a big boo-boo in choosing Danny Avdia. I thought two-way play, Jalen Johnson, versatility, two-way play. I overthought it.
You overthought? I know you made a comment about it. I didn't get your rationale, your explanation. So did you accidentally leave him off?
No. It was purposeful.
Oh, it's purposeful. Okay.
Yeah, all color makes it worse.
All right, okay.
You don't put down the mic and leave. I'd understand.
Hey, you owning it, so I give it
to
you.
I mean, we all make our choices.
Hey, man. Look, thanks for having me on, man. I had to give you some crap, man.
I mean, look, I don't blame you, man. It was a mistake. I'll tell you what, though. I wish they would release those ballots in the middle of April.
Oh, I hear you, bro.
Instead of right before the finals.
Yeah, bad timing, man.
I mean, I feel good about Wemby MVP. I feel horrible about Jalen Duren, most improved player. I had him second team. God.
Yeah,
I change some of these things.
I think we have... Do you have Chet on your All-NBA?
I had Chet 13.
Yeah, same. I think the same here.
I changed that now, too. I mean, so much.
Hey, it is what it is.
Playoff awards. Like two teams, the top 10 players in the
association. KLCC, man. Like we're adding too many awards. Man, okay. I can't keep up anymore.
That's fine.
But that's fine. That's fine. You're my guy.
Man. Yeah. I mean, and I appreciate Chris. Likewise, man. So I'm curious, this offseason, number one team you're watching for to do something big this summer?
Probably, well, before, if you would ask me this a week ago, I would have said Miami. I just think they've tried luring guys. They tried to, you know, semi-trade for guys. I don't know necessarily that they've always put their best foot forward in trying to attain guys. And I just felt like this was the year that they really had to go for it all and get a big fish. And when I'm talking about big fish, I'm talking about Giannis Antetokounmpo. Now the way OKC went out, that makes me, I have to put a spotlight on them. I don't know necessarily if it's for Giannis, but I definitely think they need to do something the way that they fell off, in the Western Conference Finals.
Second apron penalties.
Second apron penalties. Extensions kicking in. Yes. So that's the team I'm looking for. So I'll say co-teams that I'm looking at, Miami and OKC.
I think the OKC conversation is interesting because I understandably, sorry, if you're talking about a 24-year-old former champion, second in defensive player of the year in Chet Holmgren, it's understandable why an OKC fan would be like, why would we even think about trading him? But we're talking about Sam Presti, who traded Josh Giddey, a good young player, for a role player in Alex Caruso, who traded James Harden 3 months after they made the NBA Finals. He has never hesitated to make big, daring decisions facing financial difficulties with the Harden trade and then making a ballsy move, flipping Giddey for Caruso. Risky one.
Yeah, you can make a case that those are probably more ballsy moves than if they are to trade Chet. You know,
why would you say that?
Well, I think when they made the move for Giddey, right? So Giddey was I'm trying to think at the time because I had at one point the Warriors were looking at Giddey at one point for whatever reason, but when they moved Giddey to it was Chicago. Yeah, Chicago. I thought that they were going to. First of all, Giddey was caught off guard a little bit by that. He didn't know that he was going to move at that time. So I think, you're talking about Harden and Giddey. Those are guys that I didn't necessarily see happen. I don't know if you may have heard things elsewhere. But with Chet, I think the way that things folded and the fact that, listen, second in defensive player of the year voting, first team All-D, but Wemby is going to still be there. And so I think if you're going to make a ballsy move to move him, your rationale is that we still got that guy in San Antonio to deal with. So it probably makes sense for us to put ourselves in better position to just have some more versatility. And for Giddy, in that standpoint, you added Caruso. There was a lot of people that didn't like that move at the time. But you add Caruso, who is a defensive specialist, 3D guy, who's somebody who's going to just fit with the team. Giddy need the ball in his hands. So that's why I think a lot of times we get mesmerized with the guys who can pretty much do it all. And then when you get back, I would say maybe a utility guy, it's not seen as a favorable move, but it was the move that OKC needed.
How much power does Giannis have in dictating where he goes?
Ton of power. I mean, obviously he has, so after next season, he has a player option for the 2027-28. So basically next season is the end of his contract, his player option after that. So if a team that he doesn't want to go to say, hey, we want to, tell Milwaukee, hey, we want to trade, we got the assets, we're going to do this. Word's going to get back to Giannis in his camp, and he's going to say, you know what, you can do it, but you're only getting me for the season. Or if they try to trade in season, you're only getting me for a six-month rental, and I'm out. You know, it was a similar situation with Kawhi Leonard in Toronto. They ended up making a deal. They won a chip out of it, but, it was a one-year rental. I don't think Toronto have any second thoughts about making that move. It worked out in the short term. But also, Toronto didn't give up any, crazy assets to get Kawhi in the first place.
In part because the Spurs decided they want a more proven player in DeMar DeRozan over a young, raw, Jaylen Brown type of package. And do we have any indication of what the Bucks are desiring in a return?
Yeah, they want young, promising players. So obviously a team like Orlando, I'm looking at Orlando, seeing what they're going to do.
Paolo Banchero,
Banchero,
not a Jaylen Brown. That type of thing.
Yeah. Paul
Jaylen's drives it. It's a third team for young players.
Correct. I don't see Jaylen Milwaukee. You have to be another team.
Atlanta,
something like that. Yeah. And then, again, OKC, does that interest them? And I don't know. I don't know that just from the framework of their skill sets, from Shea and Giannis, I don't know that they will be able to coexist. But, we'll see. But, again, that's another reason why I have the spotlight on OKC.
With the draft, as soon as the Wizards won the number one pick, the conversation was about, are they going to try to trade down? Is Utah going to try to move up? We see now in recent weeks, Utah has worked out Mykal Brown, who is a projected pick outside the top five. Yep. We've seen the Bulls are going to have a workout with Nate Amend.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they pick 15th as well. Maybe he'll be there. Maybe he'll be top 10. These teams in the top four seem to be turning over every stone.
Yeah.
Is there any chance that we see one of these teams in the top four move out of the top four?
Potentially. I haven't heard anything concrete yet. Even with Washington's pick, they're, from what I've told, they're open to doing business. If there's a deal out there to be had where they move off of that number one pick, they're open. But definitely, these workouts aren't happening for reasons. First of all, these agents really dictate these workouts and who goes where. So the agent is not going to approve for his client to go work out for a team. Doesn't have really any serious interest of moving back or moving up to attain that guy. So these things are real.
Teams often say, tell me where we need to get to.
Yeah.
Trade up.
Yep, to trade up. Exactly. And that's what happens. That's what's it. Agents are very important in this process. So if you do see a player who may be be working out for a team that's outside the top five, and you want to this player is a top five guy. Well, it can be some movement. It's not for nothing. That's what I would say.
Chris, I'm very excited for these next few weeks. Best time of the year, the finals, draft, offseason.
Yeah, it's coming up. It's exciting. And the fact that, hold on, before you let me go. Now you're leaving me. All right, hold on, Caleb. How you feel about the new draft?
I'm excited about it.
No, the drafts, the lottery. Yeah, the lottery.
I'm excited.
You excited about it?
I think it's going to hopefully squash out tanking. My thing is, I'm not so sure that this is going to last more than the 3 years.
Yeah.
what are we really doing here if this is just a temporary thing? And then in 2029, we're talking about a whole new system.
But that's Adam Silver. He's always
incrementalist. Yeah.
But I just have a problem with there are going to be bad teams that are legitimate bad teams.
I like the draft relegation zone, though, because you're going to have teams competing at the end of the season.
I hate
to try to win.
But there's always going to be a team that can't compete.
I know.
Okay.
I know.
My God.
Well, now that team might end up with the 15th or 12th pick. That's 12th pick. That's a long
time. Yeah, that's those can go.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you to Chris Haynes. Up next, we got DeAndre Jordan.
All right, now joining me, DeAndre Jordan. DeAndre, how you doing?
I'm hot.
You're hot.
Yeah, it is 90 hot. Degrees it's in Texas, you know.
It is like hot and humid. Yeah. You can't hide in the shadows.
Yeah, there's no hot. I'm from Houston, though, so I'm kind of used to it, but I've been in L.A. for the past 18 years, so I've kind of gotten spoiled, you know?
Oh, I know. I mean, no better weather in America than in Los Angeles. I lived there for 8 years. Yeah, sometimes I wonder why I moved back to the Northeast, but I mean, hey, that's the choice I made. I'm curious, DeAndre, you entered the league at a time where bigs didn't have to shoot. Mm-hmm. They still don't have to shoot necessarily.
Yeah.
But the way the league has evolved, you were a drop coverage big man. That's how you had so much success in the defensive end of the floor. If you were coming into the league today as a rookie, what would be your different priorities as a young big in the league?
I would work on everything. I would work on everything the guards work on, everything the forwards work on, and then keep some center dirty work in the post kind of work. Just because the game has evolved so much that there really aren't positions anymore. And when people talked about that at first, it was kind of a negative thing. And, you know, centers are being eliminated from the All-Star ballot. And I think it's a cool thing now just because of how progressive the game has gotten and it's evolved and it's done so many great things internationally for the game of basketball, and it makes our league even more exciting.
You mentioned the internationally. There's been, what, 8 straight international MVPs?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Why has this happened?
I mean, the game is evolving, you know, and I think that, you know, it's really cool to see, you know, the game being dominated by everybody. It's cool to see, like, Nikola has won some MVPs and Shea and Giannis and a ton of different guys. And I think it just shows how contagious and how worldwide the game is, how people want to continue to play this sport and how good people are at it.
Now, I'm curious, you know, is there a difference you observed with those international players and their approach, their mindset compared to American players? Or
I think the mindset and the approach has to be the same if you're a professional athlete and you're even in that, but also to be in the MVP conversation, you have to have, you know, obviously a skill set, your team has to be good, different things like that. But I think the mindset between any professional athlete, whether they're domestic or abroad, is the same. But you just see the talent level of the game rising so quickly and at a rapid rate. I think it's really cool for the game. And I'm sure that there'll be an American MVP here at some point pretty soon.
Yeah. It might be someone from this upcoming draft class.
Maybe.
You keep tabs on the draft at all, the upcoming pull-up players?
A little bit, especially like, you know, when you start to see these guys play more in the tournament and big games on TV, I'll check out. But during the season, I watch a lot of NBA basketball.
Yeah. So, I mean, you played this shot last year with Derek Queen. We talk about skilled bigs. He comes in, in Maryland, he hits this like miracle shot, leaning floater, jumper, and he epitomizes, I think, kind of the growth of how big the bigs have grown, doing more stuff on the perimeter. Defensively, he has some growing to do. Mm-hmm. What are the ways you saw him grow over the season in New Orleans?
Well, he talked more. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's huge. Being able to communicate to yourself, to your teammates, different coverages, plays, responsibilities from guys, that connection, it gives everybody confidence on the floor when you're connected like that. And as a young player, it's tough. You don't want to talk loud. You may not want to be wrong. And that's, you know, a little discouraging for guys. But at the end of the day, you're trying. And I think that you're going to make mistakes. You're going to have growing pains and different things like that throughout the course of your rookie season. But I think that he and Jeremiah both really did a great job this year on talking and being more vocal and demanding things from themselves and other guys on the floor too.
Defensively, is that something you had to learn, how to communicate?
Yeah, Marcus Camby was on me every day about it. And I really owe a lot of mine, I guess, defensive IQ to him. He was extremely vocal, calling out plays, calling out players' tendencies. He knew the 5 most ran plays of the opponent. And I think that he even knew, like, side out of bounds and baseline out of bounds, which I thought he was like a witch or a wizard. You know, I was like, there's no way that you know all this. But he studied the game, and that was contagious to me, and I wanted to be able to be just like that or even better.
What did you have to do to become like that?
Watch basketball. over and over watch film of not only yourself, but the entire game. Because when I was younger, I would be like, hey, just pull my minutes. I only want to watch my minutes and see where I can get better. But it's also, I'm currently in a different flow of the game. We may be on a run. The other team may be on a run. So I think for me, being able to go from just wanting to watch myself on video to me watching the game in its entirety kind of helped me polish myself on different lineups and changes and ways they attack. And it opened my mind up to different things.
You mentioned if you were big coming in today, practicing everything.
Yeah.
I'm curious about something J.J. Redick talked about a long time ago. He said he tried to convince you to switch shooting hands.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
What do you remember from those conversations?
Well, I mean, like, I think at that point in time, so many people want to help you, and I think it's great, but too much information can be bad at the same time, you know? So it's like when I go to the line, I'm thinking about what this guy told me, and tuck my elbow, and then I'm thinking about my high school coach, and then I just missed two in a row earlier. So then you go up there and you're like, well, I don't even know what to do. So let me get this over with. But I think as I got older, the repetition, the confidence just kind of happened. And then at the end of the day, like, you're either going to make it or miss it. So it doesn't really.
So you were like, nah.
Yeah. Because then it's a whole story. Oh, he switched hands mid-season. Then it's like this whole rabbit hole.
What if he became an 80% shooter?
Then maybe I should have switched hands. I wanted to stick to what I was, because that stuff, I think it's more of a mental thing. Because you see guys like Shaq, and he's like, well, I had made 25, 30 free throws in a row in practice. And then when you get to the game, it's something different. And for me, it was more reps and to make it like a game-like situation, and that has helped me a lot.
I mean, it is interesting. Like, for me, it stood out when JJ said that, because personally, early in my career when I was doing NBA draft stuff with Ben Simmons, I noticed when he was at LSU, over 75% of his non-dunks were with his right hand as a left-handed player. And I was like, wait, floaters, hook shots, post-ups?
Like, touch is different.
Everything was with the right hand. And he had a quote at the time where he said, my dad put the ball in my left hand when I was a kid, and now it's all natural. It never became natural, obviously, for him. And then when that came out with you about your play, I watched back all your dunks that year. And over 80% of your dunks with whatever year that was, 2016, over 80% of them were with your right hand, like off your left foot. So I thought there must be something to this.
Yeah, I mean, I have heard that a ton, but then I dunk a ton with my left hand. I think it's also like my hands are big, so I could dunk with either hand. It's just, I don't know. I think dunking is more of like a comfortability thing. You know, when you're a left-handed guy, you see people do things the majority of the time with their right hand. That's why, for some crazy reason, I golf right-handed. And there's just certain things.
You write right-handed?
No, I can't. I can't write right-handed. I can't get food with a fork or spoon with my right hand. It just falls off. But I'm the only left-handed person in my family, so I think there are certain things I just saw my brothers and my cousins doing. I'm like, oh, maybe I should do it this way because everybody does it that way. But basketball is, and certainly I'm a lefty. Yeah.
I mean, also just one of the greatest dunkers we've ever had in the history of basketball. What is DeAndre Jordan's best dunk ever?
Oh, my gosh. Probably something in practice, if I'm being honest.
Really?
Yeah. Blake and I would have a ton of dunks in practice and, you know, post-practice and scrimmages during practice. But everybody's going to say the Detroit one, which I thought was really, really cool, too. But I don't know, man. I've had it. When I was a rookie, I got Theo Ratliff, which was, you know, being an all-time great shot blocker and defensive anchor. I thought that was pretty cool, too.
I mean, you've had a lot of them. I mean, the Pistons one, I'm sort of not in prison for that one.
Yeah, that was fun, though. Yeah, that was a good one.
DeAndre, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me, man.
Thank you.
Thank you to DeAndre Jordan for joining me. Up next, we got Bennett Sturts talking about his journey to the NBA.
All right, now joining me, first round pick in the 2026 NBA draft, Bennett Sturts. Bennett, how are you doing, man?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate you joining me today. I like to start out with this question here, because there's a lot of people who listen to this pod who may not know your game much. They just watch the NBA. So how would you describe your game to somebody who's never seen you play?
Yeah, it might depend, because I have the ball in my hands a lot. But I can play on the ball, I can play off the ball, and I can shoot it pretty well. So pretty dynamic on the offensive end, and Got a lot of people doubting me on the defensive end, and just want to prove people wrong on that. So, yeah, my game's just overall, I think it's pretty strong, and make my teammates better. I like to pass the ball a lot.
I mean, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the versatility aspect, because with your game, you did control a lot, the ball a lot in college, both at Drake and at Iowa. And I have a stat from CBB Analytics that I think kind of illustrates that. You created 45% of your team's offense while on the court, and you accounted for 26% of Iowa's field goal attempts, including 25% of their free throw attempts, 30% of their assists. So the ball was in your hands a bunch. But you're also a knockdown three-point shooter. For you, that ability to play on ball and off ball, has that been something that's been teams have questioned you about at all? Like, what's been that kind of process to show them, like, hey, I don't just need the ball in my hands all the time?
Yeah. First off, shout out to the Analytics team. That's pretty impressive.
That's a good set, right? I get some more for you later.
Yeah, they're questioning it because I always had the ball in my hands. Like, they don't know how I play off the ball. So, that's like the only reason I question it. And pretty much every interview I've had, every team's asked me that. And my answer is I feel like I'm better off the ball. Just because of my IQ, my ability to shoot it, and just knowing when to cut and stuff like that. I took some pretty tough shots just because people were all over me this year. So I think my percentage that what it was this year, I think it can be a lot better just the amount of space that I will have in the NBA, I think it just will be a lot easier.
Yeah. I mean, just statistically over 4 years in college. So it's a large sample size. Granted, you were on ball mostly. You made 46% of your catch and shoot threes, and those just aren't standstill three pointers. Those are off of movement, like no dip threes from the corner. You have a clear talent off the ball and definitely as a cutter as well. And I think for a point guard like you, with your ability to feel the game, read the floor, you also translate to cutting as well. And I think part of it that's interesting with you too is the conditioning aspect. Mm-hmm. You never come off the court. You played 92% of your possible minutes at Iowa last year. That was the fourth highest in the country, down from 97% of the minutes at Drake, the highest percentage in the country. What's behind that conditioning? Is there something you've done to be able to maintain that ability to stay on the floor for such long durations while possessing the ball so much?
Well, first off, I got to shout out my mom. She ran track at K-State, so I've got that in my genes. And I've always liked running, ran cross country and track in middle school and high school. So I like running. Like, most people can't say that, but I just think it's enjoyable. So I pride myself in that. And I just don't like being off the court. I like being there for my teammates, and I like winning. So being on the bench, I just didn't have control of anything. So I wanted to be out there for them. I know I'm going to be on the bench more, and I'm getting that question in a lot of interviews, but I feel like I had to pace myself these past 2 years, and I'm excited to play harder. I'm excited to not be worried about fouling so much. So just a lot of excitement in this new chapter.
Can you talk to me a little bit about that aspect, like trying not to foul? Because that was a thing with like Zach Edey, different position, different type of player. Yeah. But at Purdue, they didn't want him trying to block shots, picking up foul trouble, and getting forced off the floor because he was so important to their offense. And I think that's the thing with like a lot of star level players at the college level. And then they go to the NBA and boom, yeah, Suddenly they become a competent defender or a really high level defender. Is that something that was kind of instructed for you at the college level? Like, hey, you can't get in foul trouble at all, Bennett.
Yeah. It was coming from Coach Mack and then my agent as well, just yelling at me not to get in foul trouble because like the first Big Ten games, I had to sit because I got in foul trouble, and I just thought it was annoying not being able to use my hands on the defensive end. They always put me on shooters because I excel in that, so I had to run around a lot. But I'm just excited to just be more physical on the defensive end.
Did you always have a high work ethic? You mentioned your mom was a runner too, so growing up, you clearly had that influence. But did you always have this work ethic since you were a kid?
Yeah, no, I didn't. My middle of freshman year in high school, I got up. I started getting up at like 6 a.m. to go to the gym and shoot before school. And ever since then, it's just been a dream of mine to play in college. I had dreams like, as a kid, to play in the NBA. Never thought they'd be real. So NBA really started to become a thing after the Drake year. But work ethic's always been there. sophomore year.
A pop quiz for you. This is another stat from CBB Analytics. Over your 4 years in college, you played 5,118 minutes. This is the most minutes played by any college player in a four-year span across all NCAA divisions since blank. Who do you think?
Oh, man.
Any division, men's, women's, anything.
Oh, men's and women's.
Yeah, anything.
Okay. I think someone sent me this tweet. I think my grandpa sent me this tweet. Is it Kelsey Plum?
It is Kelsey Plum. Yeah, it is Kelsey good. Plum. 2013 to 2017 with Washington. It's pretty wild.
How many minutes did she have?
She had 5,196 minutes.
It's impressive.
Yeah, I know. That's kind of crazy. So yeah. she slightly bested you over the 4 years. Now, with your college journey, Bennett, you go from Northwest Missouri State to Drake to Iowa. You had that college dream, you said, when you were an underclassman in high school, and the NBA dream, you know, wasn't really truly real until after Drake. What was the transition from high school to North Missouri State? Like, was there not high major offers at the time? Were you overlooked? Why was it kind of a late blossom for you?
Yeah, I thought it was overlooked personally. It was during COVID, and the transfer portal started. So they were looking at just people in college. So that's when that all started. And to be honest, I didn't think I was very good. I thought it was I was okay. I was an all-state player, but like, I didn't think I was D1 good. And even like went to D2, like trying to prove myself. Like, I didn't think I was going to play or anything like that. Like, went in thinking I was going to redshirt. So, because they won 3 straight national titles before I got there. So, just keeping my head down, getting the respect of my coaching staff and teammates, and just working at it. And not taking anything for granted. And, it's pretty much it. It's a crazy journey.
I mean, it definitely is. Like, each level that the competition gets better, and then you go to Iowa last year following your head coach, and it's an awesome opportunity against even a higher level of competition. What's a big thing you learned about yourself this year that doesn't show up in the box score?
Biggest thing, I think my leadership, that really had to take a step up because past 3 years, like, we had leaders on that team. I wasn't a leader or anything like that. I was a sole leader at Iowa this year, so that obviously didn't show up in the box score. And it wasn't all pretty. Like, first Big Ten game was at Michigan State, and we got 20 balled. So we had a lot to learn. And being the leader, I took a lot of pressure in that and had to learn how to be confrontational to guys who I didn't think were working as hard as they should be or playing as good as they could be. So it was really uncomfortable at some times. But, I think the leadership – really helped me out this year.
Is it important for a point guard to be able to be a vocal leader like that?
Yeah, for sure. Just because you've got the ball in your hands all the time and people are looking at you and you've got to facilitate, you've got to call the plays. Obviously, the coaching staff's going to be all of them are going to be leaders, but like, they aren't playing on the court. Like, you've got to be the leader as a point guard.
I mean,
or at least vocal.
Oh, for sure. I think that's very important. Vocal. I don't think you can be necessarily just like the quiet guy in the locker room.
Yeah,
I mean, you can be that in certain roles, but not as a lead guard. That's important. Yeah. Like, I think that's part of what's interesting with you is, I think, like, we almost started this conversation talking about what you didn't do in college with the off-ball stuff. But ultimately, if a team's going to draft you in the late lottery or the top 20, they're going to be hoping that Bennett Sturts can be their point guard for a long time or one of their lead ball handlers. So I'm curious about your perspective of the league today with kind of the evolution of the point guard position. There's not necessarily that Chris Paul, the John Stockton type in today's game as much. There's just a lot of ball sharing offenses with multiple initiators. How do you view yourself role-wise in the NBA? Are there any players you look at around the league and you're like, I could be plugged into that spot?
Yeah, player comp-wise, I think two that come to mind are Jamal Murray, just the way he plays with pick and roll with Jokic, 6'4", get to his spot, mid-range game. And it's pretty different, but Ty Jerome, those are two pretty different players. But Ty Jerome with his pace, his frame, how he gets to his spot, how slow in his pace. I think those are probably the two main ones. yeah, the other part of your question, like what I think of point guards today, I think every good team has two point guards, and they can play off the ball or on the ball and can shoot it. So I think that's pretty valuable that just have another point guard who can do that.
I mean, isn't that kind of like what we see every year as the playoffs go deeper? Like this year, OKC, like they run out of ball handlers. AJ Mitchell, it gets hurt, and Jalen Williams gets hurt. They're running out of those guys. And the Spurs have handling across positions. The Knicks have a bunch of guys who you feel comfortable with who can handle the ball. The Celtics 2 years ago, OKC last year when they were healthy, Indiana, granted they lost. I mean, every single team across positions, it's guys who can do that, right? Have you watched much of this postseason this year?
Oh, yeah. It's been super fun.
What stood out to you? What have been your observations about the playoffs?
Pace of play, and then just how physical they are, just compared to like the regular season. Like these dudes, I love it because it's so physical and they're not calling any fouls. I love how just competitive it is and how fast they play, and just the shot making. The difficulty of these shots they're making, just it's so fun to watch.
I mean, it's pretty nuts. I mean, you saw
hard to guard. Hard to guard.
Did you see that video of Caleb Wilson at game one? It kind of went viral on social media. He was reacting to that Brunson leaning shot. Kind of, he's just like a kid watching it. He is a kid. Yeah, he is a teenager, but
we're both gonna be rookies.
Yeah, I know, right? How old are you right now?
22.
I mean, that's still super young, though, right? I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Do you feel that ageism at all when it comes to conversations with teams? How they tend to,
not at all.
No? Okay. Yeah.
No one's really like concerned about it either, which is good.
And I don't think teams should be. I mean, everybody's trajectory is different, right? You know?
Yeah.
I'm curious. You mentioned some player comps, and this may not relate to any of your comps, but I'm curious, regardless of position, if you could download a specific move from any other player in the league, what would that move be?
Golly, probably LeBron fadeaways. Good to have ability, like just Curry, his shooting and his range. But specific move, Stephon Castle slow step.
Oh,
that's pretty random.
That is random.
But I'm gonna change that one. Yeah,
I mean, he does that at a high level on those drives.
Yep. Yeah,
Castle's an interesting player because, like, it's when he's 2 foot leaping around the basket, he just turns into a rocket ship. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. You got to guess which one he's doing.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, so you mentioned Jamal Murray earlier as a guy, and I think that's an interesting comp for you because I never thought about you kind of in the Murray lens as a player, but if you were paired with a big man who could facilitate, I think that's where kind of those flashes of your ability as a cutter and as a mover without the ball would almost become realized where we haven't been able to see it in the past. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a time in your life or playing at a different level or that you did play that type of style?
Not really. I mean, we had a big man, my D2 days, Wes Treamer, who like facilitated, made it so easy to play with. But since then, like not really had a big that like got me shots. Like I'm always the one getting people shots and there's nothing wrong with that. I like doing it, but like it's just a lot easier. Like Jokic, just facilitating, getting dude shots. So I think it'd be super fun to play.
Have any teams brought that up, your D2 days, when they talk about your game at all? I'm curious.
They do their research now. Yeah, they've brought it up.
And what do they observe about that time?
I didn't really shoot it. Like I didn't have the confidence back then, so they were asking about that. That's like the only thing they brought up, but they like asked me like, why is that important in your journey? But yeah.
You mentioned the shooting, the confidence aspects. Was it purely confidence then, or was there something mechanical that you've changed over the years to become more of an elite shooter?
Purely confidence. Like I knew I could shoot it. It was just like, I just didn't have confidence and it started being better after the Charleston Classic. Drake, my junior year, played Miami, FAU and Vanderbilt, and that's like the first Power Five teams played in my life, and we beat all three of them, and that's like really where it started. Like, dang, we can do this. I can do this. I can play. I can hang with these dudes. So yeah, that's kind of where it just started, my confidence, and just launched off from there.
Has it been sort of like a snowball? Like you almost started working harder, became more motivated. with the success that's come?
Yeah, I would say like free would be the word. Like I'm playing more free. Like there's no pressure, not worried out there and not nervous during the game. I'm obviously nervous before the game, got these nerves, but just playing more free and trusting my shot.
Does it matter? Do you get to get drafted high?
No, don't matter how high I get drafted up. I just want the right fit, want a team who really wants me, who really likes me. And yeah, just sees a lot in me for my future.
I got some random questions for you, Bennett. Number one, what's your biggest motivator?
Biggest motivator? I think it's my faith. I rely a lot on that, and God's given me a lot of talents. So yeah, just playing for him out there.
Hey, were you raised in a religious family?
Yeah.
That's like, so both your parents?
Yep.
Well, who introduced you to basketball between your parents?
My dad. My dad was my high school coach. So always grew up around the kid, around the game as a kid.
You have a ball in your hands, probably pictures of you as a baby with a little kid hoop, right? Yep. Do you have siblings at all?
I do. I've got two older brothers and then one younger brother.
They must be all pretty fired up for you right now this time of year, huh?
Oh, yeah. They're the best.
What's your biggest pet peeve?
God, every NBA team has asked me that. Really? I just don't have an answer. nothing makes me mad. I'll say like people who argue to the refs like too much. Obviously, like, you're going to argue to the refs, but like every play, like you don't got to argue to the refs.
I know who you're not a fan of. We don't need to say names, but I know. Luca, what's some music that you like that would surprise some people?
Christian rap is my go-to.
Christian rap.
Christian rap. Yeah. I love that. People don't know a lot about it, but, before games, so
wow, okay, that's cool. Is there a favorite artist?
Lecrae.
Okay.
Lecrae. Yep.
What's your weirdest habit?
Weirdest habit. I like to play disc golf.
Okay.
And I play that too much.
I played disc golf once before with Mark Titus. You know the name Mark Titus, I'm sure, right? Yeah. We played together when we were both living in LA. It's fun, super fun. Had a good time.
It's free.
Yeah. I had a great time doing it, man. What do you do besides disc golf? What do you do besides basketball? What are some other interests of yours?
Yeah, disc golf is big. I'm not like a big movie or TV show guy. So hang out with the guys on the team, hang out with my fiance. Yeah, I like to be out in nature. So hike, go on walks, fish, be out in the water. Yeah.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Read people's minds.
Okay. You can't already do that as a point guard, the way you read the floor? Yeah, come on. You already got that ability. You're going to tell that to the NBA teams. They'll take you number one.
Yeah. There you go.
What do you love about basketball the most, Bennett?
The competitiveness and how much it gets out of you. Just a stupid round ball gets you places. It's just crazy. So it's taken me a lot of places. So super great for it.
Well, Bennett, I can't wait to see where it takes you moving forward from here. Excited for you, man. Rooting for you. And thank you so much for joining me.
I appreciate it. That was fun.
All right. Thank you to Bennett. Up next, we got Aaron Nkrumah talking about his journey to the league. All right. Now joining me, 2026 NBA draft prospect from Tennessee State, Aaron Nkrumah. Aaron, what's up, man?
Hello. Okay. I appreciate you having me, Matt.
So we have something in common. We're both from Massachusetts. You're from Worcester. I'm from Brockton.
Oh, yeah. It's not too far off. It's like an hour, I think.
Yeah, not too far at all. Yeah. What's the worst pronunciation you've ever heard of Worcester?
I've heard Worcester like so many times.
Oh yeah, Worcester is probably the most common one for sure.
Yeah, but
we're not too far. You grew up a Celtics fan?
A little bit. Like I like the 08 team, like Rondo, KG, Ray Allen. You know, so I guess I was a bit of a Celtics fan.
I see. So you were just a kid then, though. I mean, I was born in 1990. You were what, like a 01 baby or something? 01, like that?
Yeah. I was like 7 years old, but I still, you know, understood it a little bit, knew what was going on. So, yeah.
Were you someone more that liked to play basketball more so than like just watching on TV?
Yeah, I just played like every chance I got, like recess. Like I was a big recess like hooper. So, yeah.
Now, you've had quite the journey. You started your college career at Division III Nichols College. You transferred to Division III Worcester. I'm just going to pronounce it that way. Worcester State. You won Player of the Year there. jumped to Tennessee State. You won Ohio Valley Conference Player of the Year. You got to the NCAA tournament as a 15 seed. And then you didn't get an invite to the Portsmouth Invitational. You got a late invite to the G League Combine. You then you had 33 points over two games, earned an NBA Draft Combine invite. I'm curious, Aaron. I mean, you've essentially just been kicking down the door at every single level of basketball. When you have the season you had, you make the tournament, you don't get the invite to Portsmouth. How do you keep that from breaking your confidence time and time again?
I mean, you know, opportunity will come knocking when, you know, you're ready. So I just feel like, you know, even though I was deserving of the opportunity, but again, it'll come at the right time. So I was happy I got it and just trying to make the most of it. So.
What's the biggest difference between the player who stepped on the court at Nicholls College and the guy who forced an invite at the NBA Draft Combine?
Just more confident guy. I mean, I always knew I could play growing up. It was just more so being like a raw talent. Just stay in the gym, put in hours of work. So it all paid off, and I'm excited for the opportunity I have now. So.
Now, for people who are not familiar with your game, how would you describe your game to someone who's never seen you? What's the Aaron Nkrumah scouting report?
My scouting report, I don't know. It's tough. I know in the OEC, like, it was really all around. Like, you couldn't run me off the line because, like, I'm a good finisher. I make good decisions. You couldn't leave me open. Like, I'll hit a shot. Like, it was kind of – it was tough. But my scouting report, I just feel like it's all around. You know, I'm so versatile. I could do a lot of things on the court, whether it's – play make, put the ball in the hoop, or hit a tough shot. So, yeah, I just feel like it's real all around. So, yeah.
How many workouts have you done so far this month and last?
I've had 5 so far. So, yeah, I think I have a total of like 13, something like that. So,
what's been the most surprising or even consistent piece of constructive feedback you've gotten from executives so far?
They're really straightforward, honestly. They kind of just say, like, play your game. You know, you're here for a reason. Don't go into the situation overthinking your game. You know, they've seen what I could do on tape. They broke me down pretty well. So just not going into workouts, trying to do things out of the ordinary, just be myself. So
what's the number one thing teams want you to get better at?
Number one, I'll probably say, like, shooting, decisions off the bounce, and just keep my defense where it's at, but obviously enhance it. So, yeah, I think there's room for improvement in all aspects of my game. So,
Last season, you made 36% of your catch and shoot threes, which was the best number of your college career. It was 28% in the previous 3 years. So, have you been working on that catch and shoot jumper this off season?
Yeah. It was one thing I put the most emphasis on. I kind of just stay in the gym. You know, shoot on the gun, whether it was shooting with teammates, coaches. Like, I just really put a lot of emphasis in that. And, yeah, the numbers don't lie. So it's progressed over the years, but there's still room for improvement. So
what are some of the things that have been gone into? Is it just simply reps, or is there something mechanical that's gone into it?
Yeah, it's just reps, you know, shooting the same shot even when you're tired. Yeah, just reps on reps, so.
Okay, I see. And with you, like you mentioned, the decision making off the bounce and how good you are at attacking closeouts. I think playing within the flow of an offense, like you can see that with the way you cut to the basket, your awareness off ball, you rebound, you run the floor hard, you make the right pass, and you kind of have like some creativity off the dribble as well. How do you envision your role in the NBA moving forward?
I mean, my role in the NBA could be anything, honestly, just because of how versatile I feel like I am. So honestly, whatever organization needs, like whether it's for me to be a 3-and-D, you know, handle the ball, whatever they need. But I'm pretty sure it's probably going to be more of a 3-and-D type guy. So, yeah, I just got to be able to defend at a high level and hit shots at a high rate. So,
would you say defense is your best skill right now?
I don't know. I think all my skills are the best skills. I feel like, yeah, really, yeah.
I see. So how would you describe yourself as a defender?
I'm a good defender. Yeah, I'm a good fighter. Like, I'll sit. Like, I'm versatile, not just going back. Like,
switchable.
Yeah, very switchable. Yeah.
You mentioned you'll sit down and you'll stand. So, like, there's a. Have you always been somebody who hustles, plays hard on defense, stays locked in?
In high school, not really. I feel like in high school, I was kind of just like a scorer. But you know, as you learn more about the game, as you get older, like, you know, defense is what wins games. So you gotta, you know, really dial in on that end. So that's what it's been for me.
How much have you watched the NBA playoffs?
A lot, a lot.
What stood out to you? What have your observations been?
It's really just the physicality. You know, stakes are high. Guys play with a lot of emotion. You know, it's just really been the physicality, shot making ability, communication, like those things. So, yeah, that's really what's been stood out to me.
What teams have you liked watching?
My favorite team to watch in the playoffs is the Warriors, but obviously they didn't make it this year. So I've been watching OKC a lot. The Spurs, obviously they're in the finals with the Knicks right now. So I watched the Spurs the whole playoffs. Wemby's just a different animal. So it's good to
see. How did you first get introduced to basketball?
My brother, like, he didn't really play basketball, but he played like his friends at the park and stuff, and like I was always tagging along with him. I was never that good. I just watched, you know, all his boys play, and I fell in love with it. So I just try to be able to play with them and get better. So yeah.
When did the dream of making it to college and getting to D1 and then getting to the NBA really first kind of start for you?
So coming out of high school, obviously you aspire to go D1, you know, because that's the closest window to the NBA. So you always want to go there. And then, I just got to the Division III level. Because at the end of the day, I just wanted to hoop. Like, I just wanted to play basketball, even though I was under-recruited and stuff like that. I wasn't that good. So that was my first landing spot, Division III. I just try to make a name for myself, just try to play a good brand of basketball. So, you know, the higher ups could see at the Division I level. So, yeah, that's what it's been. And I'm just happy I got the opportunity to do so. Yeah.
What are some of your interests besides basketball?
Outside of basketball, I really like to play the game. Like, I play 2K, I play FIFA, I play Fortnite. Like, I really was a gamer growing up. A lot of my close friends know that I used to skateboard. Like, I was kind of an all-around kid. Like, I did a lot of weird stuff. But, you know, I guess that's what makes me who I am today. So, yeah.
What does that mean, weird stuff? What's that mean?
I don't know, because somebody could look at me and not really, like, think, like, I was a skateboarding type kid, like, you know, a gamer always inside all day. So, like, you know, just those type of things. So
what's something surprising about your interest in music or movies that people wouldn't expect from you?
Movies, not really a movie type guy. I kind of watch shows, like, occasionally. Movies. I'm not really
about music. Any music you like that would surprise people?
Music. My favorite artist is Playboi Carti. People gonna call me crazy for that, but I really don't care. But Playboi Carti, my favorite artist. So
is that crazy? Is like Playboi? I don't know anything about Playboi
Carti. I don't know.
Popular.
Nah, he is popular, but some people, you know, it's not really their type of music. People prefer like a more calm type vibe, but me, I'm more like I like to get riled up, like, especially pregame. Like, I like to, you know, get antsy, I feel like. So, yeah.
Last question for you, Aaron. What do you love most about basketball?
The basketball world, like, I didn't realize how small it was now until now. Like, now I'm at this level. Just the different type of people you meet, different type of players you play with. Like, it's so easy playing with guys who know how to play the game. So, that's really what it is. Just meeting the new types of people around the world, honestly. So,
well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining me today, man. From a Brockton guy to a Worcester guy, wishing you all the best, man, and rooting for you.
All right, man. I appreciate you.
Big thank you to Aaron, Bennett, DeAndre, and Chris for joining me on today's episode. I'll be back again on Tuesday with a Game 3 reaction. I can't wait for that one. Hope you all enjoy the rest of your weekend. Thank you to Emmy and the team for producing today's episode. Have a good one, everybody.